Hello, and welcome to the podcast for weeks 2, 3, and 4 of ECCS 252, Introduction to Computer Engineering, Fall 2008. With the first midterm safely behind us, it's time for us to move on to some interesting and fun stuff. Actually all of the material in this podcast will be based on Chapter 3 in the Patton Patel textbook, where we focus really on the fundamentals of digital logic structures. We started out with a basic introduction to CMOS, or complementary metal oxide semiconductor technology, CMOS technology. We talked about both NMOS and PMOS transistors and how they are used to construct logic gates. We also did a brief overview of the planar structure of these devices and the process called photolithography, which is used to manufacture them. We're all looking forward to the WCAM tour to see an actual clean room in operation and find out a little bit more about the details of that manufacturing process. The first major topic of the chapter, really four major topics, three of those will be covered in this podcast, the fourth one I'll leave for the next one, but the first major topic is logic gates and how they are actually built, again using these NMOS and PMOS building blocks. We use the NMOS transistors to create pull-down circuits and the PMOS transistors to create pull-up circuits that allow us to, subject to the input values being presented to each gate, either pull the output up or pull the output down, depending on whether we want to, in the case of an inverter, invert the output, or in the case of a NAND gate or a NOR gate, pull the output up or pull the output down, depending on particular combinations of the inputs. You should be familiar with the truth tables for all of those gates, both the NOT gate, which is obvious, AND, OR, as well as NAND and NOR, which are the common building blocks that we use in CMOS because it's usually, or it's much easier to build, complementary forms of logic in CMOS than the true AND and OR. Basically, the way these things work is we have either parallel or serial, always the dual or opposite in the NMOS and the PMOS pull-up and pull-down circuits, structures of switches that will, given the combination of inputs supplied to the circuit or to the gate, will either pull up the output again, like I said, or pull the output down if the conditions are correct. We showed that it's a fact that all logic functions, all possible logic functions with Boolean inputs or true-false inputs can be created from these basic building blocks. In fact, we even showed that all we really need is just the NAND gate, since we can synthesize or create an inverter, an AND, and an OR gate simply by combining instances of a NAND gate in different configurations. And the only tricky part there was constructing an OR out of a NAND, and we needed to use De Morgan's law, which basically allows us to convert an OR structure into an AND or an AND structure into an OR by inverting the inputs as well as the output. So we talked briefly about De Morgan's law, a topic that will come back to haunt you if you decide to take 352 later on. The second major topic of this course, or of this chapter really, is how to build logic circuits from these gates. So given that we have a fundamental set of gates which are sufficient or universal and can build any logic function, how do we actually implement circuits that can implement those functions? Generally, we'll either start with a truth table, which just enumerates all combinations of inputs and the corresponding outputs, or with an algebraic function that describes the output in terms of its inputs, expressed in terms of ANDs and ORs and NOTs in parenthetical terms of those inputs. We start with this description, and then we can always create a two-level logic circuit with an AND gate that decodes the corresponding input combinations that correspond to ones in the output column. We have one AND gate for each one in the truth table in the output column, and then we have a single OR gate that combines all of these AND terms together. And that's sufficient to implement any truth table, any function expressed as a truth table. And again, all we really need to do that is inverters, ANDs, and a single OR gate. We talked about some other circuits that can be useful in various applications. The first of these is the decoder. The decoder basically takes N inputs and expands them to a 2 to the N output. So we have an N-coded N-bit input. And on the output side, we have 2 to the N signals, only one of which will ever be active, depending on which particular input bit pattern is being provided to that decoder. We see how decoders were used in memories a little bit later. The second higher level structure that we talked about was the multiplexer. A multiplexer just selects one of 2 to the N inputs and routes it to a single input, so it's kind of like a multi-position switch, and it makes that selection or performs that routing based on an N-bit select input. Finally, we talked briefly about a full adder. A full adder is a circuit that adds two binary digits and a carry-in term to generate both a sum for that bit position and a carry-out, which gets carried into the next bit position. And we saw how we can string these full adders together by connecting the carry-out of a less significant bit to the carry-in of a more significant bit, and keep repeating this process in order to be able to add multi-bit numbers together. The third major topic of this chapter was really memory. We started out by describing the basic building block, the underlying building block that we use in modern memories today, which is called an RS latch, or a reset set, set reset latch, which consists of two cross-coupled NAND gates, where there's a feedback path from the output of each NAND to the input of the other one. We learn to really think of that RS latch as a configurable inverter loop. So we can use an inverter loop where one inverter is connected to the output of one inverter is connected to the input of another, and conversely the output of that inverter is connected to the input of the first inverter, which is basically just a loop that allows us to store a bit. We can think of an RS latch as just an enhanced inverter loop where it operates in two different modes. In the first mode, it's really just an inverter loop. And the way it operates in that mode is if we convert the two NAND gates in the RS latch to inverters by tying the second input to a 1. Whenever we tie one input of a NAND gate to a 1, it behaves as if it's an inverter. And in that mode, we're essentially able to store in the RS latch a single bit without perturbing, and it remains there statically as long as we supply power to the circuit. But we can then use the two inputs, the S input connected to the top NAND gate and the R input connected to the bottom NAND gate, to either set the bit in the inverter loop to 1 by pulling down the S input, or resetting the inverter by pulling down the bottom R input, resetting the bit stored in the inverter loop to a 0. The problem that we ran into with RS latches is that it's possible to shoot yourself in the foot when using them, because it's possible to provide an incorrect input sequence. If you pull both R and S low, effectively trying to both set and reset the bit that's stored in the inverter loop at the same time, unpredictable things happen. And basically the circuit can go into a metastable state where we don't know what the actual value is that's being stored. This is a very, very bad thing. We want to avoid this at all costs. And in general, with careful design, even though we use RS latches, we can avoid that situation. But instead, what we often do is we actually build a slightly different version of the RS latch called a gated D latch, which is much safer and easier to use because it, by construction, disallows this incorrect input. So a gated D latch adds two more NAND gates to the front end of the RS latch, and basically these additional gates provide the following additional features. First of all, instead of having a separate R and S input, there's a single D input. D is for data, and we can use that D input to specify whether we want to latch a 0 or a 1 into that inverter loop when we decide to actually store a new value in it. Then there's a second control input called WE, or write enable, and when we activate that input, when we pull it high, that's when the D input is copied to the latch as well as the output value Q, and then as soon as we disable the write enable or pull it back down, that's the bit that gets latched and stays in that latch until we perform a subsequent write. And whenever that write enable signal is inactive, the gated D latch simply stays in its storage state and keeps the current bit in the inverter loop. We showed then how, given that we have this primitive single-bit building block called a gated D-latch, we can string these D-latches together into a one-dimensional vector. We call that a register. A register can, of course, be anywhere from 2 to n bits wide. The individual bits in the register are typically, by convention, numbered and can be named with a square bracket array subscript notation. So that, for example, if you have some register Z that's 10 bits wide, you could extract some of the middle bits, say, by using a notation like Z sub 7 colon 5, which would give you that notation would extract bits 7, 6, and 5 out of that 10-bit register. By convention, we typically number these bits with the least significant bit as 0, and the most significant bit as n minus 1 for an n-bit register. For a 16-bit register, the most significant bit or leftmost bit would be numbered 15. We can also arrange these D-latches into a two-dimensional structure rather than just a one-dimensional register. And these two-dimensional structures are conventionally called memory. And in a memory, we basically have M bits per row, which form the minimum addressable unit for that memory. Usually in today's computer systems, that's 8 bits or 1 byte. If we have a byte addressable memory in our system, that means that the word size for the memory is 1 byte. The smallest quantity that you can access in terms of reading from it or writing to it is 8 bits. But actually, for the machine that we are going to be using in the book, the LC3, the word size is actually 16 bits. So each word in memory is actually 16 bits in size. A memory also has 2 to the n rows given an n-bit address. So that n-bit address is able to specify 2 to the n different possible combinations of bits. Each of those combinations corresponds to an entry in memory. We usually number them from top to bottom, from 0 to 2 to the n minus 1. Memories support two operations. We can either write all m bits in a row or in a word, or we can read all m bits. And whether we're writing or reading, the address that we're reading or writing is specified by the n-bit address that we supply to the memory. Physically, a memory consists of, again, a two-dimensional matrix of D-latches, where to access that, we basically decode using a decoder that decodes an n-bit address into 2 to the n word lines. We decode that address, which asserts a single word line that spans across the entire row of the memory. And then, if we're performing a write, that horizontal word line is connected to the write-enable inputs for all of the D-latches in that row. And whenever we assert that horizontal word line, that means we're basically going to write a new bit into every entry or every D-latch in that row. The D-inputs themselves are connected to vertical bit lines that span the array from top to bottom. And when we, again, assert the write-enable input, we're going to copy the write data that's on those bit lines into each latch. For a read from memory, there's also a horizontal word line, which again is driven by a decoder. That word line drives an n-type pass transistor, which connects the Q output of each of these D latches to vertical bit lines as well. Now the vertical bit lines are used to transport data from the D latches to the bottom of the array, where they can be then read out and sent elsewhere in the system. So in summary, in a two-dimensional memory, we have horizontal word lines that select which row is being read or written, and then we have vertical bit lines which either transfer data to the bit cells from the external write data port, or from the bit cells to the external read data port if we're reading from the array. Real memories use exactly these kinds of arrays. But there's never just a single array in a structure. There's a hierarchical structure of them. So, for example, the physical memory in a PC is usually comes in these dual inline memory modules, which there's usually more than one of these in your system. So there's dual inline memory modules, each of which can say, if two of them each contains about half of your total memory. Each DIMM has multiple memory chips, let's say 8 actual memory, physical memory chips on it. So again, 1/8 of 1/2 is now stored on each of those memory chips. And then each memory chip itself has many, many instances of these arrays within them. So basically, as you provide an address to such a memory system, you use some of the higher-order bits to pick which DIMM you're going to go to. If there's only 2 DIMMs, you only need 1 bit. And then within the DIMM, you'll use, if there are, let's say, 8 memory chips on the DIMM, you'll need to use 3 bits of your address to pick which one of those memory chips you go to. And then the remaining bits in your address will be used to determine both which array within that chip is actually read from, and then within that array, again, you do the word line decode to determine which row is actually being read from. We also discussed briefly the different types of memory that are used in computer systems today. The type of memory we've been discussing here is SRAM, or static random access memory. We call it static because each bit cell has static behavior. Once you've written a bit to it, it doesn't change as long as you continue to supply power to the chip. The main physical memory in typical computer systems consists of DRAM, dynamic RAM. So SRAM is usually used on chip, onboard the processor chip itself, where we need memory that's typically faster and easier to use. But for the off-chip memory that is in the system, we'll typically use DRAM. Dynamic RAM, and the main difference between SRAM and DRAM is structurally they're very similar, but the bit cells themselves in DRAM are much smaller, because rather than consisting of D latches, they're actually the bit itself is actually stored using a small electrical component called a capacitor. Capacitor is sort of like a leaky bucket. You can dump some, you can dump some water into it and slowly it trickles out. But as long as you read from it soon enough, you'll still be able to determine that there's water in the bucket. Similarly, a capacitor, you dump some charge into it, it slowly leaks away, and as long as you read from it quickly enough, your data value is not corrupted. But again, the bit cell itself has this dynamic behavior where it slowly decays. And so the challenge with DRAM is making sure that you either read the contents before they get degraded, or you have to refresh them. And refreshing just means reading out the contents of the bits and then writing them back. So you're sort of looking at the bucket saying, is there water in it? If there's water in it, let's refill it all the way to the top so that it will have some additional time before it decays. We also talked briefly in class, this is not in the textbook, we talked briefly in class about non-volatile memory. Non-volatile memory, in contrast to SRAM and DRAM, will maintain its contents even if you remove the power from the chip. So both SRAM and DRAM, if you turn off the power, will lose their contents, but non-volatile memory, the most common form of non-volatile memory, of course, is flash memory, which is commonly used in MP3 players, digital cameras, and so on. Flash memory has a property that it does not lose its contents even if you remove the power supply. Flash memory uses a technology called floating gate technology, which is really beyond the scope of this course. But it actually, if you look at it inside the chip, it looks quite similar to the transistors that we've already been covering when we talked about NMOS and PMOS transistors used to create the pull-down and pull-up circuits within logic gates. So that's pretty much it for the material we've covered in weeks 2, 3, and 4. We do have one remaining major topic in Chapter 3 that we have yet to cover, which is the design of state machines, which are used to build sequential logic. So that's still to come, something for you to look forward to for next week. Just a brief reminder that homework 4 is due Wednesday, October 15th in class, so make sure you're getting a timely start on that assignment. That's it for now.